So thank you for that. Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener. Thank you, Fahima Mohammed, broadcaster and TV presenter from London. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here, we enlighten you with the Ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzad Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa ma takunu fi sha'ni wa ma tatlu وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories. Hamas calls for independent and international probe into mass graves in Gaza. Yemeni armed forces carry out multiple operations on anti-Israeli linked vessels. And pro-Palestine campus protests continue to erupt all across U.S. campuses, also in Europe, in the French capital, Paris. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Now more than 200 days into Israel's genocide in Gaza, and the regime continues to pummel the war-wracked territory, claiming more civilian lives. Israel's latest airstrike has killed at least 8 civilians in a Tal al-Ahwa neighborhood there west of Gaza City, an Israeli drone strike near the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza left 4 people dead, including 3 children. In central Gaza, Israeli artillery shelling on the Wadi Gaza Bridge and the Nusayra refugee camp claimed 5 civilian lives and injured several others, and a number of residential buildings were also targeted by regime warplanes. Palestinian health officials say Israeli forces have now killed at least 43 Palestinians and injured 64 others in just the last 24 hours, and the total death toll from regime's campaign of genocide has now exceeded 34,300, along with 77,300 injuries. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called for an immediate, independent, and international probe into mass graves discovered under Gaza hospitals. The movement urged international organizations, including the UN, to form an independent commission to investigate Israel's heinous crimes. It also asked the UN and relevant international organizations to send specialized forensic teams to help identify the recovered bodies. Hamas warned such crimes should not be ignored and their perpetrators should not be provided with any cover to help them escape punishment. Palestinian civil defense officials have reported evidence of field executions in the mass graves. Say a number of bodies had their hands bound while others still had medical tubes attached to them, indicating that there were patients there at the hospital and buried alive. Political analyst Thay West joined us earlier and says Israel's always been getting away with crimes, and this has encouraged the regime to commit even the most heinous of crimes.
This situation, it got out of control a long, long time ago. I mean, we're talking about over 7 months ago, this whole situation was out of control, where the Israeli government, with the complicity of the United States, the American government, they allow massive crimes to be committed by the Netanyahu regime. And it's just like a child. If you allow a child to do certain things over and over again that's not good, then that child will continually do that. So Israel is doing these things, and they're getting away with these things. So each crime becomes worse than the previous crime. It is good that the United Nations High Commissioner, he did rightfully say, as we all agree, that this is horrifying. This is a horrifying situation with these mass graves that have been uncovered there at two hospitals there in Gaza. Now, the fact that it was two hospitals, not one, but two hospitals, that indicates that the Israeli regime committed these war crimes with no remorse. They did it once at one hospital, and then they did it again at another hospital. And then it's also a disregard for a human life.
The World Food Program warns famine is imminent in northern Gaza as Israel continues to bar aid deliveries into the besieged territory, exacerbating an already dire humanitarian situation.
We're still heading towards a famine. We haven't seen that paradigm shift that is needed to avert a famine. We need more volume, more predictability, and a sustained effort to get more diverse assistance into the north.
Second, speak to Haiti, given that this...
Saku added the current aid flow is significantly less than what is desperately needed. Israel's been waging starvation war in parallel to its genocidal onslaught, which started back in early October. Some 2 million Gazans are struggling to get access to food amid Israeli restrictions on the entry of humanitarian aid. International aid groups have time and again warned that the besieged territory is progressively moving toward famine and is becoming unfit for human life. The Yemeni army says it carried out new operations against Israeli targets in support of Palestinians in Gaza. According to Yemen's army's spokesperson, the first operation targeted an Israeli ship in the Gulf of Aden with missiles and drones. Yahya Sadi added Yemen's armed forces also fired ballistic missiles at several Israeli targets in al-Rashrash port area south of occupied territories. Sadi stressed Yemeni army will continue to prevent the navigation of Israeli-linked vessels in the Red and Arabian Seas, as well as the Indian Ocean. He noted that Yemen's operations will also continue until Israeli genocide in Gaza comes to an end and a permanent ceasefire enters into effect. And we discussed Yemen's military operations against Israel and also in response to aggression against the country by the U.S. and the United Kingdom earlier in our news review program.
We are joined by Mr. Hossein Abu Khaiti, activist and political commentator from Sana'a, and also Mr. Salim Nazal, president of the European Palestinian Cultural Forum from Oslo. Gentlemen, thank you for being on Press TV. Now, Mr. Abu Khaiti, I'll begin with you. Obviously, with the latest, the reports that we have so far is that the Yemeni army has carried out two operations. The first one was on an Israeli ship in the Gulf of Aden, and also the targeting of the al-Rashrash port area south of the occupied territories.
Yeah, I mean, those latest attack actually is a clear message, and they shows that the U.S. and U.K. aggression against Yemen actually did not stop Yemeni ability from targeting Israeli ships or Israeli-linked ship, as well by targeting U.S. and U.K.-owned ship just in the last 24 hours. Yemeni has targeted today this Israeli ship in the Gulf of Aden, and yesterday they have targeted a U.S.-owned ship and as well an Israeli-linked ship, and on the top of that, they did as well target a U.S. destroyer. This is a clear message that Yemeni army will continue its attack and as well targeting areas in south of occupied Palestine in around Eilat city. Shows that Yemeni as well ballistic missiles unit were not actually affected by the attack from U.S. And United Kingdom aggression. And as Sayyid Abdul Malik have made it clear today in a speech that there is no reduction of attack, but the reduction is actually that the ships linked to Israel are actually trying to avoid to go through the Red Sea. And since the aggression against Yemen, as well since the Yemeni started to form a blockade, as he said, they have targeted more than 100 ships, and United States naval ship actually are not able to protect neither Israeli linked ship or their own ship. And when they got actually involved, they are actually made more target for Yemeni's naval force to target those ships owned by those two countries. And I believe, as Sayyid Abdul Malik have said, that they will expand their attack even in the Indian Ocean.
That's right. Mr. Nazal, welcome to the news review section. Sorry for the wait. Now, Mr. Nazal, how do you see the courageous operations by the Yemeni people in support of the Palestinians, especially taking into account that the Yemeni people themselves were in a war with Saudi Arabia, I think it was for about 9 years, and they are one of the poorest countries in the region. And can you draw a parallel to some Arab and Muslim regional countries like Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain, to name a few? How can the Yemenis stand against the U.S. and their allies, unlike those countries that I just mentioned?
Thank you for the invitation. Well, I see the Yemen position as it should be seen, with the great respect, with the great appreciation for this heroic and solid position of our brothers in Yemen. I mean, probably I might say that for many in the world, the strong Yemen position was a big surprise. And we have now sort of two veto in the world. The veto which United States do it at the United Nations to defend the Israeli and Zionist genocide in Gaza, and we have the veto of the Yemen, the blockade of the Yemen, in order to stop the genocide. As I said before with another interview, I think that Yemen is working according to the United Nations Charter, because in the United Charter it is the duty of all countries to stop genocide. Yemen is just doing this, trying to stop the genocide. And as the brother in Sana'a said, the Yemen is not doing any aggressive thing. Yemen is defending the Palestinian people, trying to stop the Zionist massacre in Gaza.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Mr. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator from Sana'a, and also Mr. Salim Nazal, president of the European Palestinian Cultural Forum from Oslo. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And with that, we come to the end of this news review section. Thank you for listening.
From California to Texas to Massachusetts, protests by U.S. university students against Israeli genocide in Gaza have shown no signs of abating despite serious police clampdown on the campuses. Around 30 protesters were arrested on Thursday at Atlanta's Emory College, where police used tear gas against the demonstrating students there. University of Texas also faced similar crackdown by police forces in riot gear at Emerson College in Boston. Classes were canceled after police clashed with protesters there overnight. Now, over 100 people were also taken into custody there at Emerson. Wave of pro-Palestinian protests on U.S. campuses began a week ago at Columbia University in New York after scores of protesters were arrested there. Students are demanding universities divest finances from manufacturers that sell weapons
to the Israeli entity. And students at different universities throughout America have been holding pro-Palestinian campus rallies against U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Jewish community has also been participating in the rallies to support the Palestinian cause. Protesters gathered near U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer's residence to protest the recent approval of more military aid to the Israeli regime. And we take a closer look at the issue in our explainer program.
Protests in the U.S. have reached fever pitch against the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Many different demographics are involved in these protests, like students, but one particular group is showing itself more, and those are Jews, who are not only against U.S. aid to Israel, but also against Zionism. For starters, about 300 people were detained near the U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's residence in New York. They were mostly Jewish New Yorkers who were protesting the $95 billion aid package, of which $26 billion was going to Israel. The protesters also included rabbis. Now, why was Chuck Schumer picked for a protest site? Recently, he said about Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, "I worry that under his leadership, Israel would become a pariah in the world and even in the United States. Without American support, Israel's future," he said, "could well be over." These remarks, unthinkable a decade ago, a sign of changing times in the U.S. From a Jewish American politician to a Jewish American protester who was also arrested at that site, who said, "We as American Jews will not be used," adding, "We will not be complicit and we will not be silent. Judaism is a beautiful 1,000-year-old tradition and Israel is a 76-year-old colonial apartheid state." And here is their banner. Look at it very carefully, especially the spot in the middle where it says, "Jews say stop arming Israel." That's what they're saying, not in their name. And that is something that they're focusing on, hence why they say not in our name, against the U.S. also. What is apparent is there is a generational shift that was unheard of for a U.S. politician to speak this way about Israel. Are U.S. politicians tired of Israel? How many have only been pressured by Israeli lobbies to support Israeli security at the cost of Palestinian lives? Lobbies like AIPAC, for example. Which is why there is a Jewish anti-Zionist movement that is leading the fight for Palestine against the Israeli apartheid regime. It's called Jewish Voice for Peace. And that's a massive movement, and it describes itself as the largest progressive Jewish anti-Zionist organization in the world. Their slogan, "We have a plan to end U.S. support for Israeli's oppression of Palestinians." There are other groups as well. The movements share a common goal to organize a grassroots, multi-racial, cross-class, intergenerational movement of U.S. Jews into solidarity. Well, they hold the view that American Jews and Jews worldwide believe that Israel is a Zionist settler project and does not speak for all the Jews or represents a haven for Judaism. Now, all of these elements or groups united against the apartheid regime of Israel points to how Israel has lost its legitimacy. We've just pointed out some of them here in a list. As one analyst said, this is how apartheid South Africa was dismantled since it lost its legitimacy.
Now, U.S. unbridled support for Israel's crimes in Gaza stirs some strong anger both globally and within the ranks of the U.S. government. And now State Department's Arabic language spokesperson resigns due to opposition to Washington's policy on Israel's onslaught in the besieged Gaza Strip. Hala Rarit is the State Department's third employee to resign over U.S. support for Israel's campaign of genocide. Just last month, Anel Shaleen, an employee at the State Department's Human Rights Bureau, announced her resignation as well. And John Paul, a former State Department director, resigned back in October. Tariq Habash, a senior official of the U.S. Education Department, also stepped down in, I believe it was January. Now, the U.S. has come under mounting criticism, both internationally and from human rights groups, over its support for Israel. More than 1,000 officials of the U.S. Agency for International Development signed an open letter in November calling for an immediate ceasefire in the besieged Gaza Strip. The U.S. continues occupation in northeast Syria through its illegal military presence, stealing the resources of the Syrian people in gross violation of international law. That's it for your latest, and bye-bye for now.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The limelight.
Unless a ceasefire is called, it appears certain that Gaza's hospitals and medical workers will be subjected to further attacks. that disease will spread and that more people will die from conditions that are both preventable and curable. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Reem Omar is worried about the health of her family. Two of her four children have contracted hepatitis. The first sign of infection came when Reem noticed that her daughter's face had turned a sickly shade of yellow. After a few days, her daughter, who had become quite thin, had a high temperature and diarrhea and started to vomit. Reem initially sought help from Medical Point. Its workers felt a more thorough examination was necessary and told Reem that her daughter should be taken to the Kobeti Hospital in Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city. Hepatitis A is closely associated with poor diet and a lack of clean water. Reem is convinced that the scarcity of food in Gaza caused her children to become ill. She said, there are no fruit or healthy sources of nutrition that help children and adults to fight diseases. Following mass displacement, more than 1 million people remain crammed into Rafah, despite reports that some have recently left the city. Jamal Alhams, a doctor at the Kuwaiti hospital, noted that displaced people are living in very difficult conditions and there is no protection from viruses and epidemics. He said, we used to receive 100 patients a day in this small and simple hospital. Today, we are talking about receiving 1,000 or more patients with infectious diseases during a single day, not to mention the many cases of injuries because of the ongoing war on Gaza. The few remaining hospitals in Gaza are overwhelmed. The Zionist regime has been attacking the healthcare system without mercy. The World Health Organization has described the situation as heartbreaking. Among the sites targeted are Ashrafa, Gaza's largest hospital. Last month, the Zionist regime carried out one of the worst massacres in Palestinian history there. Within the past few days, a mass grave has been found at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. It contained at least 180 bodies. Unless a ceasefire is called, it appears certain that Gaza's hospitals and medical workers will be subjected to further attacks, that disease will spread, and that more people will die from conditions that are both preventable and curable. Meanwhile, the website of the New Arab wrote, hundreds of cases of respiratory illnesses have been reported in the Gaza Strip, the territory's civil defense said recently, attributing the rise to Gazans resorting to cooking over firewood due to cooking gas shortages. In a statement, the civil defense said that families across the war-hit territory, particularly Gaza City and other northern parts, have resorted to cooking with plastic utensils over firewood and charcoal over the past 6 months, emitting poisonous gas, as reported by Anadolu Agency. The Gaza Strip has long suffered from cooking gas and fuel shortages as a result of the Zionist regime's ongoing blockade of the coastal enclave since 2007. Shortages have been further exacerbated by Tel Aviv's brutal military onslaught on the Gaza Strip, as well as its total siege, depriving residents of basic essentials such as food, water, and fuel. It has trickled into the territory in insufficient quantities, with severe shortages persisting, particularly in the north of the territory. The statement read, "The Israeli occupation's continued prevention of the entry of cooking gas into the Gaza Strip, especially to Gaza City and the northern Gaza Strip, portends a new humanitarian and health crisis in light of the ongoing aggression against our people. For many months, citizens have been relying on alternative means of lighting fires from wood and charcoal, which has caused many to suffer from respiratory illnesses due to the use of plastic and chemical materials to ignite the fires, which emit toxic gases." The statement warned of the worsening cooking gas crisis and its danger to the lives of residents who have been suffering catastrophic conditions since the start of the Israeli aggression last October. The civil defense went on to urge the international community to pressure the occupation to allow the entry of cooking gas. Concerns have also been raised about respiratory illnesses caused by the accumulation of waste and the failure to dispose of it safely, due also to fuel and power shortages. The UN has also sounded the alarm on the increase in respiratory tract infections and other illnesses in Gaza. The child-killing regime of Israel has launched a brutal military onslaught in Gaza, murdering at least 34,049 Palestinians since October 7th, most of whom are women and children. Much of the territory has been rendered uninhabitable, as residential buildings and other infrastructure has been flattened. The Zionist regime's atrocities have been described as akin to war crimes, while South Africa has accused the Tel Aviv regime of carrying out a genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
Holds its breath as West Asia stands on the brink of what resembles a third world war, pushing the region towards an uncertain future. The language of threat and intimidation continues to dominate, especially after Iran's unprecedented True Promise operation against Zionist Israel. The operation marked the first time in history that a direct attack was launched from Iranian territories to target occupied Palestinian territories. Consequently, from a strategic deterrence perspective, where Zionist Israel stands at awe of the escalating events, the region remains shrouded in uncertainty amidst heated verbal warfare regarding the nature, timing, and military and strategic implications of any sort of uncalculated retaliation, amid warnings of a gradual slide into a comprehensive regional war with unpredictable consequences. Hence why the Islamic Republic of Iran warned last week that if Zionist Israel retaliates against Iranian nuclear sites, the nuclear doctrine in Tehran could change in an apparent threat to begin nuclear weapons production in the event of escalation. Now, Islamic Revolution Guard Corps Brigadier General Ahmad Haq Talib, commander of the unit responsible for nuclear sites, issued the threat in a Thursday interview with the Islamic Republic news agency IRNA, ahead of the miniature Israeli entity counterattack on Iran, which involved three quadcopters launched from inside Iranian territories. Haq Talib told IRNA that if the Israeli regime intends to resort to the threat of attacking our nuclear facilities as a means to put pressure on Iran, reviewing the current doctrine and nuclear policies of the Islamic Republic of Iran and distancing from past considerations is possible and conceivable. The threat highlights how tensions are continuing to spiral in the aftermath of the unmatched True Promise operation. This Iranian warning came 2 days after statements by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, expressing concern about the possibility of Zionist Israel targeting Iranian nuclear facilities. The issue is that Iran usually refers to its rapidly expanding nuclear program, which has enriched uranium to near weapons grade, as a deterrent against the Zionist entity, which itself is nuclear armed, while at the same time denying that it has any intention of building a nuclear weapon. However, the Israeli entity's impromptu strike on Iran's embassy compound in Damascus should have been a heads up for everyone, as it represented a dangerous new chapter in the long, formerly hidden, currently disclosed open war between Zionist Israel and the Islamic Republic of Iran, which just might be pushed to change its current peaceful nuclear doctrine into a military one. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. Western countries are intensifying their pressure and sanctions on Tehran in an attempt to appease Zionist Israel. At the same time, the Islamic Republic of Iran has begun to contemplate the possibility of changing its nuclear policies in the event the Israeli entity attacks its facilities. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohammad Hassan Swaidan, a strategic studies researcher, a writer for different media platforms, and the author of several studies in the field of international relations. A pleasure having you with us, Dr. Swaidan. Now, how does the unprecedented True Promise operation by the Islamic Republic of Iran intensify the escalatory process in the region and signify a potential shift in the dynamics of the conflict between both Iran and the Zionist Israeli entity, especially in the terms of the nuclear deterrence here?
At the beginning, one of the most important consequences of the Iranian attack is that the war between Iran and Israel, the Israeli entity, is now out of the shadows. Iran and Israel have always been in war, but now the war is out in the shadows, not as it used to be before, more depending on security operations and on Iran supporting the axis of resistance and being part of it. This idea threatens or frightens the Israelis, since if you go and study or read what Israelis state about Iran, they believe that Iran is the leading threat, the number one threat they face in the region. They classify Iran as being the country that could cause the most damage to Israel, and that's why they feel threatened about it being active in the region. If you follow up with what Israeli leaders used to say before October 7, you can see how much they used to depend on threatening Iran, trying to deter it from being active militarily against Israel. Well, today, after April 14, Iran showed that it has the will, it has the power to be active against Israel whenever needed. The idea, as simple as it is, threatens Israelis. It led to their deterrence, and if you see the Israeli response, you can obviously see how much deterred they are, how much frightened they are, and most important, how much dependent on other superpowers they are, like the US and Europe. And this idea of being this scared, this frightened, and this dependent really threatens Israeli leaders, and they know that this is today because Iran showed them that it has the will and power to be active against it whenever it needs to do so.
Well, it is truly interesting to see how Iran's position might be shifting, which basically depends on a lot of variables. But there are certain implications for this kind of change in mind for the Islamic Republic of Iran regarding this potential change in the nuclear doctrine if Zionist Israel is to attack any of its nuclear sites. Does this threat contribute to escalating tension in the region that we are all living in, millions of people at the moment, or it is rather a de-escalation, given the fact that it might be a threat for Zionist Israel to calm down and take multiple seats already?
Well, I think that Iranian leaders speaking about changing the nuclear doctrine will lead to a de-escalation in the region, and that's because Israelis are most afraid of a nuclear Iran. So whatever they can do to not lead Iran to have a nuclear bomb, they will do. They thought before October 7 that they can force Iran not to have a nuclear power by using their power. Well, April 14 saw that this doesn't work anymore. The dynamics of the conflict changed, and they know that in order for them to avoid Iran changing its nuclear doctrine, they have to abide by the Iranian rules, meaning they have to decrease their military activity against Iran. I think Israelis will do whatever needed to avoid a nuclear Iran, and that's why they need to de-escalate. Iranian leaders sent a clear message that not only they have the power, sometimes you have the power but you don't have the will, so this power won't be of benefit to you. Iranian leaders shown Israel that they have the power plus the will. And this convinced Israelis that they need to de-escalate, they need to abide by the Iranian rules in order not to lead Iran to change its nuclear doctrine. And that's what Israelis believe today. And that's the reason they had a very weak response or retaliation against Iran. They would never have done this weak retaliation if they weren't deterred, and this was shown with their response.
Well, this also considering that we are dealing with a kind of a cult of an entity. What they do is impulsive. They don't think. They go ahead and proceed with uncalculated attacks. The same attacks that we saw against the Islamic Republic of Iran in Damascus, for example, in their embassy, consulate building of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. And then we have seen that Iran did not stay still. It did retaliate. It was an unprecedented attack. Yet it also said, as we are discussing, it might change its nuclear doctrine. And as I said, it has multiple variants here, because there is a fatwa from Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the revolution, that there will never be a nuclear weapon in Iran. But listening and hearing this coming from the Iranian generals, top Iranian generals, it does suggest the evolving nature, if you will, of the ongoing conflict in the region of West Asia, especially between Iran and the Zionist entity, and especially after they saw that Iran actually does what it promises, and after they revealed what kind of tactics they have in their pockets in the event there was an escalation by the Islamic Republic of Iran. So they basically just opened their pockets and showed Iran how all of these nuclear powers are ready to defend Zionist Israel, which itself is a nuclear power. So in that sense, do we really think that Israel is deterred?
Well, I think how nuclear powers in the world helped Iran is indeed an idea that frightens Israel and doesn't help it. If you read Israel national security strategies, previous ones, and if you read what Israeli elites write, they believe that one of the most threatening ideas for Israel is being dependent on superpowers. One of the consequences of October 7 and then on, one of the consequences of April 14 is that it shows how much Israel is a dependent entity. It has always been a dependent entity, and now it showed more that it is a dependent entity, and this idea threatens and frightens Israel. This means that it can't live alone, and by with Iran being more militarily active in the region against Israel, Israel today is much more frightened that it can't bear to be alone in a region where many countries are threatening it. It has to depend on other nuclear powers, and that's what will drive its decisions in the later stage. It will be more abiding to its to the countries that are helping it, and it will be more abiding towards the rules of the conflict with Iran. Israel now knows that the dynamics changed. It has to change its relations with the West. It has to be more abiding to them, because without this West, it will be vulnerable in the region. And it has to change the dynamics of the conflict with Iran too, because Iran showed Israel that it has the power and will to do whatever needed. And it's with no doubt that Iran left the round victorious, the last round victorious. And it will work on building up on this victory in order to achieve a new relation or a new type of conflict with Israel, a type of conflict where it is victorious inside it, where it has a leverage inside it, and where Israel is more deterred inside it. And all of this is what now comes in mind for Israeli leaders, being a dependent entity, being a threatened entity, being an entity that is threatened by many countries, and being a frightened entity in a region where they are convinced it will never be a safe place for them. And in order to live in the region, they will always be dependent on super nuclear powers.
Mm-hmm. Well, they will not have the capability to continue further, as it's seen by the region's native resistance. It's always a pleasure having you with us, Dr. Mohammad Hassan Sweidan, a strategic studies researcher, writer for different media platforms, and author for several studies in the field of international relations. Always a pleasure having you on board.
Thank you.
Thanks a million for your time. Ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about the attacks on the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Over the weekend, Iraqi security sources revealed that the Kalsu base in Musayib, south of Baghdad, was the target of three air raids. The attacks, suspected to be carried out by drones, aimed at the main entrance to the base and an office belonging to the popular mobilization forces Hashd al-Shaabi. More details in this following report.
A three-raid aerial aggression targeted the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi Kalsu base in Musayib, south of the Iraqi capital Baghdad, this past weekend, killing one person and injuring six others. The aggression targeted the main entrance to the base and an office belonging to the popular mobilization forces known as Hashd al-Shaabi in the area leading to the Project Highway north of the Babylon Governorate. In the meantime, Iraqi airspace remained bustling with the usual American air traffic, as confirmed by Iraqi media, which reported the monitored movement of an American air refueling plane in Iraqi airspace. Furthermore, another U.S. State Department plane was tracked moving from Baghdad towards the Lebanese capital Beirut following the aggression. U.S. Central Command CENTCOM refuted what it described as reports of American planes conducting airstrikes in Iraq, stating in a brief statement released following the aggression, "We are aware of reports claiming that the United States conducted airstrikes in Iraq today. Those reports are not true. the United States has not conducted airstrikes in Iraq today. In turn, the international coalition led by the United States stated, coalition forces did not participate or strike locations in Iraq. We are monitoring reports of an incident in Jurf al-Sakhr and remain prepared to support our Iraqi partners. The Secretary General of the Sayyid Shuhada Brigades in Iraq, Abu Ala al-Walai, commented on the aggression, saying, "We will respond to whoever is behind the attack on the PMF base." Walai also stated that those proven to be involved after completing the necessary investigations will pay the price, clarifying that if the enemy believes that the hands of the popular mobilization forces are tied by official orders, then it should not expect a response, as resistance is not like that. A few hours after the aggression, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq announced launching drones that targeted a vital Israeli occupation site in Eilat within the territories occupied in 1948, confirming that the targeting is in support of the people of Gaza and in response to the Zionist enemy's violation of Iraqi sovereignty by its treacherous targeting of PMF camps. The Iraqi government has repeatedly said it wants to end the presence of foreign forces in the country after the U.S. carried out deadly strikes targeting Al-Quds Force commander, martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and his comrade, Deputy Director of the Hashd al-Shaabi, Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in January 2020. Since then, the U.S. has carried out multiple assassinations targeting leaders of the Iraqi resistance in Baghdad and other governorates. Strikes came in the wake of the Iraqi resistance's operations in support of the people of Palestine, targeting American occupation installations and troops in Iraq, Syria, and Jordan since October 17, in retaliation to Washington's support for Zionist Israel in its genocidal war on Gaza.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mataz Wahwah, political commentator. It's a pleasure having you with us, Brother Mataz. Now, who do you think was behind the recent aerial aggression against the Hashd al-Shaabi base and the surrounding area, since the aggression was denied by CENTCOM and by the international coalition? So that leaves one perpetrator, but they never officially said they did. So who was really behind it?
Well, first, thank you for having me on board. In regards to your question, I think whether we say it was the Zionist regime or whether it was the coalition, I think they're two faces to the same coin, right? So it's not really, it's not that important who the actual pilot is. But all indications at the moment point towards the Zionist regime. And we know that they've carried out these covert airstrikes in the past, and they have no problem in having the resistance in Iraq or any other player in the region sort of pin it on the United States. They hide behind this U.S. presence in the region. And this is one of the dangers of having the coalition in the region, is that as long as the coalition is there, then the Zionist regime can always hide sort of under their cover and carry out strikes like this and then just say nothing and leave the blame onto the United States.
Mm-hmm. So the United States, as we said, the Central Command and both the international coalition, they denied to have any involvement in the reported airstrike. Yet hours after the attack, we saw that the Iraqi resistance announced launching bomber drones towards the Palestinian occupied Eilat. And also we saw some sort of aerial movement for the State Department, the U.S. State Department, from Baghdad to Beirut as well. But if it were to be really Zionist Israel and not the Americans this time who conducted the attack, wouldn't at least both who denied involvement, the U.S., the coalition, even Jordan, for that matter, wouldn't have they known that there would be an attack of this severity against Iraq? And if they did, wouldn't that make them all equally responsible and possibly hold the consequences of this responsibility?
Absolutely. So let's make one thing very clear. There is no aerial activity in the region without CENTCOM knowing, right? Mm-hmm. Their aerial defense systems cover pretty much the entire region. Their satellites, their radars, they can pick up the smallest of drones, which where it took off, what time it took off, what kind of drone it is. They have this intel. So no one's buying that they had no prior intel. They at the very least knew that there were jets in the air heading towards Iraq. Where they came from exactly, we know that the Zionist regime, they have air forces all over the place. They have air force bases all over the place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we can't be too certain where they took off, but no one is buying that they had no prior knowledge. Yeah? They at least had knowledge at the as soon as the attack was underway. And yes, definitely this makes them a partner. Their mere presence in the region makes them a partner to any aggression against Iraq or Iran or Syria or Lebanon. It makes them a partner to all, even Gaza. It makes them a partner in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Some people do debate, Mr. Mataz, that they are not really partners as much as they are the main perpetrators, because they are funding this war and arming the Zionist entity. If the arms stop, the genocide would definitely stop, because Zionist Israel does not have the capability to continue on its own. But what really interests me, before we discuss what the Iraqi resistance, how it retaliated and what they said, what really interests me is the role of certain Arab regimes in all of this. We did see, for example, Jordan closing down the airspace against Iranian retaliation on Zionist Israel. It had nothing to do with Jordan, yet they did it. We also saw Jordan again opening its airspace for Israeli airstrikes and Israeli drones to go all the way to Aleppo, for example, a month ago when the Israeli entity did an airstrike there, or to Iraq, for that matter. That puts a grave responsibility on the Arab people themselves, don't you think?
Absolutely, yeah. So starting off with what you first said in the statement you made, when we say partner, definitely we're saying that the United States is the main perpetrator and they're the main player in this. So whether it's a Zionist regime or even these Arab puppet states, all of them solely, they exist solely to serve the interests of the United States. Solely, there is no other reason for their existence. Like I said, whether it be the Zionist regime, the sheikhdoms that exist, a fabricated nation like Jordan, a fabricated monarchy, an artificial monarchy like Jordan, they solely exist to serve the interests of the United States and the West. So yeah, that's covered. And this sort of answers your second question regarding these Arab regimes, specifically the artificial kingdom of Jordan. Jordan's existence, its survival depends on its servitude to the United States and to the Zionist regime.
Mm-hmm.
They have no other reason to exist. This is why they're there. This is why they're maintained. They don't have an economy to rely on. They don't have an export that they're known for. They don't have oil.
And they don't even have democracy, the last time I checked.
They have zero democracy. It is the most policed Arab state that exists.
Mm-hmm.
And it is horrendous. And this issue of the Arabs supporting the Zionist regime is not new, you know. In the words of his Eminence Sayyid Hassan, I remember in the 90s, during 96, I think it was during the Grapes of Wrath, he was speaking about the smell of Arab fuel from the Israeli jets, that we could smell the Arab fuel. It's always been Arab fuel that was fueling it, sometimes even money, mm-hmm, that was going into these aggressions.
Well, Brother Mataz, the Secretary General of Sayyid Shahada Brigade's Abu Ala al-Wala'i vowed to respond to the attack on the Popular Mobilization Forces. We did see earlier on Monday a response on American occupation bases in the region, which had stopped for more than 2 months. Now they are back on the track. In what ways do you think that the Iraqi resistance are willing and are capable to escalate the situation further in the region?
Well, the Iraqi resistance, the mere fact that they can strike Eilat from all the way in Iraq and have their drones go undetected, and they've been doing this since October 7, is an indication of their capabilities, and I think we haven't seen anything yet.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they struck both Eilat and coalition forces in Syria and I think in Iraq, there was last night an attempted attack,
mm-hmm,
goes to show that they view both as one and the same. Both is one and the same. They are both responsible for aggressions on Iraq and aggressions on Gaza, and it shows that not only are they militarily capable, but they have this political foresight to understand where to strike, who to strike, and how to strike them. And without a doubt, those that can defeat a terrorist force like ISIS can most definitely, and before ISIS, they were able, these factions were capable of expelling most of the coalition forces from Iraq. They are more than capable of fighting a squatter state like the Zionist regime and whatever's left of the U.S. coalition.
We might see a probable scene of more missiles probably coming from Iraq this time, not only from Iran.
Yeah, so indications are that there will be an escalation from Iraq. The Iraqis took a sort of moral high ground a few months ago and said that, you know what, we'll cut back our strikes against the U.S. coalition. And
because they were practically asked by the government, because supposedly there was some sort of an agreement that the Americans are leaving, but I think that they never put their actions where their words are. We're used to that. That's what colonialism is all about. I want to thank you very much, Brother Mataz Wahwah, political commentator, for joining us to discuss this blatant attack on the Iraqi resistance and their heroic reply and retaliation against those perpetrators, against the Ummah in general, and the free peoples of the world. Thank you very much, ladies and gents, for joining us on this episode of the Mideast Stream. And we promise to always get you the latest updates right here from the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.